celebrating the music and movies of John Hughes.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
It seemed a very optimistic time in the 80s. These kids struck me like kind of innocent and hopeful. It was a lovely movie. I'm really glad I was part of it.
One of the things that he said to me, which has never left me, because I was just so struck by it when he said, is he said, you know, I don't worry about any kind of story problem because I know I can write myself out of anything. And I was like, oh goodness. Oh my gosh. Like, to have that strength, to have that ability to know that, like, put me in any corner, I'll write my way out of it. That's the greatest power there is in Hollywood.
Welcome to the podcast Life Moves Pretty Fast, which celebrates the movies and music of the late, great John Hughes. I'm the journalist Hadley Freeman and a John Hughes superfan. And joining me, as always, is Tarquin Gotch, the wonderful music supremo who was John Hughes's music supervisor and many other things on many of his best loved films. So Tarquin, what are we talking about today?
Some Kind of Wonderful, the last teen film of John Hughes. Not entirely true, that, actually. I've just started our relationship here, Hadley, by lying to you. It's not the last teen movie. There was another teen movie in the 90s called Career Opportunities, but this really is the last of the sort of significant ones. Some Kind of Wonderful came in possibly the most intense period of John's filmmaking career. In 1986, we'd had Pretty in Pink and Ferris Bueller. In 1987, Some Kind of Wonderful comes out. But during the making of Some Kind of Wonderful, he's directing She's Having a Baby and getting ready to direct Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So it's hectic. And I asked John about why he did it. And his answer to me was that comedians are funny. They're funny, 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 and then they're not funny. John Cleese springs to mind. Mel Brooks springs to mind. Blake Edwards springs to mind. These are great comedians who've done some of the best work ever, but then suddenly they're not funny. And John lived in fear of that happening to him, so just wanted to go as fast as he could while he was funny. But he also had a different reason, which he gave to Bill Brown. Once asked him, why so many films, John? Why this punishing pace?
Because if I stop, they won't let me make movies again. And as absurd as that sounds, I think that this is the core of being a writer, is there's always this imposter syndrome that goes on. One anecdote that I'll tell you about where his head was really at, I think it was when we wrapped Uncle Buck. It was at the time where Warner Brothers, you know, they had the fleet of jets. If you were on the fly list, you could borrow the jet. And we had flown out to Breckenridge to go skiing. And it just so happened that one of the nights we were staying in the condos at Breckenridge, it was the Oscars. So we got together that night to all watch the Oscars. And I'll never forget it, because the whole night, John was just wandering around, not really paying attention, you know, kind of would glance over at the TV, but he was doing, in typical John fashion, doing stuff and distracted by other things. And then they got to the screenplay awards and he came right up and sat on the edge of his seat and just didn't blink. And then as soon as the screenplay awards were given, he got up and started like walking around again. And it was at that moment that I realized, like, oh, this is where this guy really lives, being a writer.
This is a film directed by Howie Deutsch, again, who directed Pretty in Pink. And it very much is a sort of mirror of Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
The two films sort of complement each other or look at the same triangles from different points of view.
Right, exactly. So Some Kind of Wonderful tells the story of Keith, played by Eric Stoltz, a soulful, artistic, working class boy. His best friend Watts, played by Mary Stuart Masterson, who's a tomboy who likes to play the drums, and his crush on the pretty girl at school who, despite hanging out with the rich kids, is herself also working class, called Amanda Jones, played by Leah Thompson, best known to 80s film fans as the mum in Back to the Future, and also the future Mrs. Howard Deutsch, in fact. So she ended up marrying the director of this film.
She very nearly didn't take the role.
Oh, really?
In fact, she turned it down.
So was this before or after The Duck? Because that was the kind of...
Well, that's part of the story. She turned it down because she was star of Howard the Duck.
Howard the Duck.
Which was, in Hollywood terms, about as surefire a big hit as you can get. And it was looming. And then Howie got into real casting insecurity and could not find somebody to play this part. Howard the Duck goes out and bombs. It doesn't just not do well, it bombs. And Leah very quickly changed her mind. In her defense, the script had also changed quite a lot from when she first read it to when she said yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were more reasons than one for her changing her mind. And I'm glad she did, not just for Howie's sake, because he met his future wife, but because she does a great job.
So she went from Howard the Duck to Howard Deutsch, basically.
Yes. Well spotted.
And so she plays Amanda Jones, who is working class, beautiful, who has a rich boyfriend who is very mean, called Hardy, played by Craig Sheffer. And the film is about Keith's love for her and Watts' love for him. And Amanda Jones's uncertainty, does she want to give up her status with the rich kids and be with nice, soulful Keith or what? And as you say, this is another perspective on the love triangle that John Hughes wrote about in Pretty in Pink, in which it was two poor kids, Andy played by Molly Ringwald and Ducky, and one rich kid played by Andrew McCarthy called Blaine. And in his original script, John Hughes had Andy and Ducky get together. The audiences didn't like that, so then he had to have Andy get together with Blaine. In this film, spoiler alert, everybody, Keith and Watts do end up getting together. So the two seemingly platonic friends do end up getting together, unlike in Pretty in Pink. He changed the dynamic a little bit. Obviously, there's a sex change. And this time, the one who's pining is a boy, is Eric Stoltz, not Molly Ringwald. But the biggest change, it seems to me, is that all three of the kids are from the same social class. There isn't the kind of class barrier anymore, which maybe John Hughes thought actually is insurmountable. Maybe a rich kid won't lower themselves to be with a working class kid, as seemed to be the trouble with Pretty in Pink. So it's interesting how he changed that a lot. It's like he didn't feel that social class barriers could be transcended in high school.
No, that's right. And the film starts with Heath sort of walking through town, literally walking over to the wrong side of the railway tracks. There's a dramatic shot where he just jumps out the way of an oncoming train. And he goes and he looks across the street from where he lives, really, to her house, and their houses are very similar.
Mm.
They, you know, right at the beginning of the movie, you establish that they're of the same socioeconomic class.
So, right.
You know, it's about the course of true love and what's so called because they wanted to call her Moon after Keith Moon. But thankfully, somebody, you know, wiser thoughts prevailed and she's called Watts after Charlie Watts.
Oh,
because her big thing is drumming. And so they were looking for a, you know, back to our, you know, obsession with the names that John came up with. So Watts, yes. Because the movie starts with her drumming to Propaganda,
right?
A ZTT act produced by Trevor Horn, no less.
Now, one thing to say about Some Kind of Wonderful is that it wasn't a hit alone among John Hughes's great 80s teen films. Why do you think that was, Tarquin?
Some people have said it's because Molly Ringwald wasn't in it. They'd very much, you know, began to associate John's teen films with Molly. It could also be that the reviews did all talk about the similarity to Pretty in Pink. So I suppose if you've seen 16 Candles, Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink, do I need to see this one?
Right.
Guy, you know, Keith, very pretty. They had to reshoot the first 2 weeks of the film because Keith wasn't handsome enough. They had to go back and make sure that he looked pretty. In the initial scenes, they'd made him look too sort of rough and not attractive enough. And of course, you know, Howie and John were both twitchy on this subject coming out of Pretty in Pink.
When John Cryer wasn't seen as handsome enough to be the romantic lead.
But does Eric Stoltz have that sexy thing that, you know, Robert Downey Jr. or James Spader, does he? You know, again, we're back to that casting and script being absolutely right. But I'm not sure he was the sort of sexy idol that teen girls were after.
Poor Eric Stoltz. It feels mean doing this because, you know, he had just actually, well, at this point it was 2 years earlier, I think, but he had been cast as Marty McFly in Back to the Future and shot quite a bit of it when Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, who are the director and writer of that film, fired him because they felt he didn't have the energy to play Marty, which is true. There's something very laconic and sort of slow, a bit sort of passive about Eric Stoltz, whereas Michael J. Fox is all about energy and he's bouncing around all the time. He's running. He's got to get there on time. He's got forward propulsion. And here he is. Here's Eric Stoltz playing as quiet, soulful, poetic teenager. In some ways, it's a great casting, really, but he doesn't have the thing. He's not quite the lead character.
Also, we've moved on from the early teen films, which were about being right in the middle of high school. This, like Ferris, is about leaving high school behind.
Yeah.
It is at the tail end of your high school experience where you're looking ahead at where you're going to go next. And maybe the teenage audience in, you know, America just didn't want to go there. But no, because they went there with Ferris.
Yeah.
Do you think John was a teenager, that his character was somewhat teen-like, you know, the avoidance of conflict, the dropping of friends?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was that aspect of it. And I think that one of the magical things about him was I don't think he ever really like lost touch with that.
I agree.
When I was working for him, I wasn't that far from that age anyway. So for me, it was like, it just seemed right. But he always did have a little bit of a Peter Pan aspect to his personality, I think.
This is much more melancholic than Ferris. This is one of the most melancholic of the teen films.
Yes.
It's thoughtful and romantic. It doesn't have the physical comedy that John introduced into his films when he was the director. But John went to college, but dropped out. And that sort of brings into, you know, the other big issue of this film, which is parental expectation.
Yes, and I think part of the problem with this film is it suffered in comparison to another film that came out at around the same time about many of the same themes, which is Say Anything by Cameron Crowe. And actually, John Cusack would have been perfect for Keith. That is a great casting of a weird working-class kid, as he plays Lloyd Dobler in Say Anything, who does persuade the beautiful girl in high school to go out with him, who seems weird at first, but actually when you look at him, is completely irresistible. And that's more of the kind of actor that they probably needed to play Keith in this. And there's so many overlaps between Some Kind of Wonderful and Say Anything. Parental expectation, the close parental relationship we see between Keith and his dad, played by, I'm so sorry, I don't actually know the actor's name.
John Ashton.
John Ashton, who I think of as the detective from Beverly Hills Cop. And his relationship with Keith is quite similar in a lot of ways to John Mahoney, the dad's relationship in Say Anything, to his daughter, played by Ione Skye. Just this very close relationship, and then it turns out the dad was wrong all along. The child teaches the dad, which is a common theme, as we've said, in John Hughes films.
Interestingly, this is not a nasty dad, not a dad with problems. The only issue is his expectations don't match his child's ambitions, which very much was what happened to John Hughes himself. You can imagine when he phoned his parents to say, I've dropped out of college, how joyful they would have been. So, you know, and also this film gave John the chance to sort of get that ending for Pretty in Pink that eluded him and Howie.
Yes.
So the two of them, you can sort of almost see them together plotting, you know, our some kind of wonderful revenge. We're going to make that ending work, and we're going to have audiences absolutely love it.
But do you think, because of the similarities, obviously this was an itch that John Hughes needed to scratch, rectifying the end of Pretty in Pink, that's what he does with Some Kind of Wonderful, was there also an argument that he was running out of ideas for teen movies?
No, I don't think that's true, because what John did endlessly with his films is look at triangles or situations from different points of view. What is the difference between the vacation family movies, The Great Outdoors, possibly Uncle Buck? John's looking at these, say, the family unit and having fun with it and looking at different dynamics. And that's what he's doing here. But I mean, in the last podcast, I talked about how he sort of fell into making teen movies because he knew that teen actors wouldn't pull rank on him. If you're a first-time director and you work with a star, you're in danger of being somebody bigger on the set with more power, which, you know, John would not have wanted. With the next film, which was Uncle Buck, he wrote it from the adult's point of view. Mm-hmm. It's a teen film. Mm-hmm. It's about a teen with problems, a teen girl who's really got issues, but it's from Uncle Buck's point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
While he was directing that, he noticed how test audiences loved Macaulay Culkin. So when he sat down to write the next film, he wrote it from Macaulay's point of view, and then he kept going. Once he'd done that, and of course had the success we had with Home Alone, there was no going back. I mean, now, from there, he went on to write from iconic characters' point of view, Dennis the Menace, or Flubber, though I don't think Flubber had a point of view. Robin Williams had a point of view about Flubber, but never mind. You get the idea. I don't think he ran out of ideas. I think that's unfair.
And what, for you, is the best scene in Some Kind of Wonderful? Do you have a favourite moment in it?
I do. Yeah, I do. And now, sadly, this one song is not on the brilliant box set that inspired this podcast. We couldn't get it. It was one of those tracks that the film company didn't own the rights and the record company didn't own the rights. And Stephen Duffy and I tried to find somebody who would put their hand up and say they had the rights. And the song is called She Loves Me. And it's in The Practice Kiss.
Oh, yeah. That's a lovely scene.
It's a lovely scene. And why is it a lovely scene? It's because Mary Stuart Marston takes charge. Oh, but it's just a lovely idea, isn't it? Mm. And we've all thought, oh, if only I... Oh. And, you know, apparently it was the first time they'd kissed. And, you know, she really was blushing. And it's just a cracking scene. What about you?
Well, I do always love his museum scenes. So obviously the best one is Ferris Bueller. And in this one, we get another museum scene when Eric Stoltz takes Leah Thompson when they break into the museum at night. I just find there's something very sweet about John Hughes's idea of the ultimate kind of teen fantasy, so being in a museum. So I always enjoy that. But what I really love is the music in this movie. This has the most songs that I don't recognize, but that I love. The bands aren't as recognizable to me. So can you talk us through the music in Some Kind of Wonderful, Tarquin?
You know, we'd started a record label. He'd started Hughes Music Record Label. And I was under, you know, instruction, delightful instruction, to find as many new bands as possible. And I think we fulfilled that brief. And I'm immensely proud of the soundtrack to this movie.
The Some Kind of Wonderful soundtrack was great. It had the Jesus and Mary Chain, Flesh for Lulu, Furniture.
Ron Payne.
Stephen Duffy, who's a personal favorite of mine. Lick the Tins. I mean, what a fabulous, fabulous track Lick the Tins had on Some Kind of Wonderful.
And it was a huge disappointment that it didn't perform at the box office and therefore give any of these bands the liftoff that Pretty in Pink gave to the Psychedelic Furs and OMD and Suzanne Vega. But, you know, we signed Flesh for Lulu and they had a fantastic track called I Go Crazy, which is in two scenes. Both involve being driven. Amanda drives Keith home and then Watts drives Keith and Amanda on their date. And the song plays under that. Though I would never drive somebody on a date, ever. In Ferris Bueller, there's the bedroom scene, and there's a lot of kind of cool posters on the wall.
Yes.
As the set PA, did you have anything to do with that?
I was still the set PA on Ferris. Yes, that was my last one. Well, obviously the set decorator is in charge of decorating the sets on the movie. You know, they always want to work with the director. They're just going to put stuff up and the director doesn't know. So I think we just got in the office a bunch of promo posters from record companies or record stores. And there's a couple, three Flesh for Lulu posters used in Ferris's bedroom, along with Brian Ferry and Simple Minds. And there's, of course, Simple Minds had already been in Breakfast Club at that point. So, but here's the long, convoluted story. At this time, having got to know Les Mills with the Psychedelic Furs and Preening Pink, Peter Weber worked in Les's office. And he was friends, personal friends, with James Mitchell, the drummer from Flesh for Lulu. So James gives Peter, who then sends in to us, this demo cassette of I Go Crazy. David Anderley was the music supervisor for the Preening Pink album and movie. And I remember him passing on that demo of I Go Crazy by Flesh for Lulu, but I really liked it. So I would keep it kind of in circulation here and there, bung it onto a couple of cassettes, play it for John, remind him, you know, this is not to disparage David Anderley, and the Preening Pink soundtrack is great. And there wasn't a whole lot of extra room in there anyway, but it made sense by the time Some Kind of Wonderful came around. So the I Go Crazy song was recorded, you know, Stephen Haig, which was, I thought was a really nice idea and was a little unique at the time to hire a producer to record a movie soundtrack album from scratch with the same producer. Usually you just license in existing songs. The Some Kind of Wonderful soundtrack album, all the songs recorded from scratch with Stephen Haig.
They didn't take off, did they, like the Psychedelic Furs did off the back of Pretty in Pink?
No, they were a single release off Some Kind of Wonderful and with a great video shot by Nick Egan.
Absolutely. No, there was a measure of success, but not the sort of total liftoff that, say, Simple Minds or Psychedelic Furs did off the back of Pretty in Pink. And sadly, as we've already mentioned, this was sort of the last of the teen films, really. John went off to do The Great Outdoors and Home Alone, and there just wasn't room for teen unknown, you know, so the whole sort of raison d'etre of the label disappeared.
In terms of the kind of retro music, because we've talked about the contemporary music that's on the movie, what retro music is there? Because obviously Some Kind of Wonderful is an old song.
It is an old song. Well, actually, we haven't got a lot in this film. Retro music was more John than Howie. John would use music for jokes. He would use music as titles for his films. And those often came from the music he was listening to while he was growing up. But in fact, in this film, I'm just looking at the list here, and the Rolling Stones, Miss Amanda Jones. I mean, that's about as retro as we get. Mm-hmm. You know, otherwise it's Jesus and Mary Chain and Billy Idol, Furniture, My Brilliant Mind, one of my favorite tracks, and Lick the Tins, of course, who closed the film, I think, rather brilliantly. And it was one of those songs that I was really pleased to find. And here we have Alison talking about it. Where did you first hear Can't Help Falling in Love?
My family, all musicians, and my younger brother, he used to play it. And he had a nice chord sequence. It was like D, A, B minor. And I remember learning it. And then I used to sing it in a kind of Marlene Dietrich accent, like wise men say. And anyway, Simon heard Ronan and I playing it. Ronan Hayden was my partner, and we were in a band together with Simon, like the Tins. And he heard us playing it one night. We used to have music sessions in our house. And so I mind the cat. But Ronan was also in a band with Simon Ryan, who was the drummer of like the Tins. He was also a graphics designer for different record companies. And I think it was working for Stiff. Anyway, he heard us play it, liked it, paid for a demo tape and sent it off to record companies. And Sedition Records, it was a small label, they bought it and offered us a contract. So on the strength of the demo tape, we went into Alaska Studios. Pat Collier, a wonderful producer, produced it. At first, the tune was too short, and Ronan wrote another verse, but that wasn't allowed by the publishing company. So then we sort of made the opening a little bit. It was just drums and whistle. And then we added on the three polkas at the end to make it the sort of regulatory 3 minute long pop tune.
I heard it well in the cab. The cab driver was playing it. And that's good. And we were looking for a song for the end of Some Kind of Wonderful at the time. And I played it to John. I think he knew it from Elvis Presley's version of Can't Help Falling in Love, which was in his film Blue Hawaii in 1961. But I played it to John and he loved it. And we took it to Howie Deutsch, who was the director, who put it in the film. When did you see it for the first time actually in the film?
It wasn't for a few years after we split up, I think. Simon told me about that it was going to be put on, and I was quite thrilled. I actually watched it recently because I knew I was going to be interviewed. I watched it the other night, and it's quite joyful at the end. It's very joyful. The music comes up very joyfully. I thought just very apt.
It's very romantic, and it's better than the Elvis Presley version because you, a lady, are singing it to a guy.
Yes.
That fit the film just perfectly, because Watts, the character who's been in love with Keith, the handsome guy, you know, can't help falling in love with him, and she sings it to him, and the rhymes are all much better when it's being sung by a lady. The effect of the track being in the film, there was an effect, wasn't there? Because in fact, the record company went on to...
Then they went on to give us a deal to make our album, A Blind Man on a Flying Horse.
That's right. So it was good for us all.
Well, it really was, yes. And I'm still very proud of that song. You know, some people thought it was a bit corny. It was quite quirky, but I think it's a bit of a masterpiece myself.
I'm going to second that thought because it consistently gets mentioned as one of the sort of undiscovered gems in Some Kind of Wonderful. So, you know, I can't thank you enough for, you know, letting us have the song. And here's another band signed to Hughes Music who appeared on the Some Kind of Wonderful soundtrack and later Planes, Trains and Automobiles. The band is The Blue Room, and here I am talking to their singer, Linda Hall. I think your cassette was handed to me by a friend, Peter Price, over at 10 Music.
Uh-huh.
At that time, before I got in touch, were you aware of John Hughes and his movies?
Not really, no, to be fair. I was just doing my own thing, so I wasn't really, I wasn't really aware of what was going on around me. I was just so busy working myself.
From your side, how did you find out that one of your songs might be in a John Hughes film?
Well, wasn't that from you?
It was. But I didn't call you, Linda, so somebody else must have.
No, apparently you discovered us down the Fulham Palace Road.
Yep.
We kept getting discovered, you see. We were one of those acts that kept getting discovered. People kept wanting to sign us, and then they'd do a bit of recording and then went by the by. But you found us.
Yep.
Was that through the Pet Shop Boys?
No. Tom Watkins was the Pet Shop Boys manager, wasn't he?
That's right.
Yeah.
Because he'd managed us and the Pet Shop Boys. They'd taken off. And so his attention, quite rightly, went to them. And then we were flapping about in the wind again, you know. And then you came along.
And then I came along. And I think the first song I heard was Cry Like This. Does that sound right? Was that one of the early songs?
Yes, and Trust in Me. Yeah,
yes.
Cry Like This and Trust in Me, yeah.
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 We signed you to Hughes Music and asked you to record with Stephen Haig. How was that?
Oh, quite an intense man. Yes, that was great. I mean, the ultimate professional. And we did Cry Like This, I'm Afraid, and Trust in Me. I think he really believes in the music. I mean, they're really great songs. So, yeah, he was very enthusiastic. Very.
Has there been an effect from the work you did with in the John Hughes films? Do people come up to you at gigs when Blue Room plays? Does it register with people or has it sort of just faded?
It hasn't faded. In fact, I was in in the Apple shop yesterday, and I just mentioned to a young man, because I had to get some leads together, and he said, he said, you're very fortunate to have been involved in that. I said, yes, I've been very, very lucky, you know, before you were born, I said. But so it shows, I mean, the youngsters, it's like a cult thing for them. They really love it. They love those teen movies more so than at the time. Like now, it seems to have more prevalence than years ago. Now the kids, they hark back to a simpler life as well, when things were more fun, you know. And let's face it, fashions haven't changed dramatically, have they?
Well, what, you're still wearing big shoulders, are you, Linda?
Well, no, not the big shoulders, but it's more or less the same, which is kind of sad, really. You think things might have moved on, but it was a great time.
It was also at this point that, because Some Kind of Wonderful is so similar to Pretty in Pink, I think that some people were starting to satirize the John Hughes tropes. So the most obvious example is Heathers, which came out just 2 years after Some Kind of Wonderful, which is all about, you know, making fun of this idea of the high school as this very divided, hierarchical place, and also taking the idea of the outsider and making him a very threatening character, which is what Christian Slater plays. He's the kid who doesn't fit in, who ends up shooting or blowing up the high school. And the whole trope in John Hughes of kids teaching their parents, that is very much satirized in Heathers, where Christian Slater calls his dad son and his dad calls Christian Slater dad. And it shows how skewed that is. When kids are teaching their parents, that leads to these weird kind of toxic confusions within families. There was a kind of familiarity being bred around these high school movies, which isn't fair because I think they're all really different and they have very different emotions underpinning all of them. But maybe John Hughes was becoming aware that his movies were being seen as a kind of formula at a certain point.
Yeah, I suppose it's inevitable. And then you have to wait for the next sort of wave, which I suppose in England was The In-Betweeners.
Well, I mean, what's sort of sad is that he just had to wait a few years. It's really Clueless. And Clueless reinforces a lot of what John Hughes said, which is that high school is very divided. And there is this big awareness of social class in American high schools, which totally tallies with my own experience. The rich kids kind of have a social cachet in high school, which the less wealthy kids don't have. Obviously, the difference with Clueless is that the young actors in it all look like models and they're all very sexy and they're all, you know, fearless about sex. One of the interesting changes in Some Kind of Wonderful to John Hughes's earlier films is the idea that one of the characters is having sex. It's very explicit that Leah Thompson's character is having sex. We see her at the beginning of the movie, Craig Schaffer is leaving her house in the morning. And then he says later to Keith, I'm glad you're getting her used. And that makes sex seem like quite a scary thing, something that for a girl, you know, boys can use against you, that you're giving up a power in a sense, rather than something that's just kind of carelessly fun and easy, which is how it's portrayed more in more traditional and later teen movies like American Pie. You know, I'm not saying that John Hughes is being judgmental about sex. I don't actually think he is. I think he's actually being quite true to how a lot of teenage girls feel, which is that this is something that you do because the guy wants you to do it, but actually, what does it mean for you? And I think that's very sweet and sensitive, the way he portrays it.
When asked about these films, John described it as, for teenagers, their problems are big. Adults dismiss them because they're not about, you know, keeping a roof over your head or paying the bills or you know, life and death stuff. They seem insignificant to the parents. But to the teenagers, they're huge. And that ability to look at things from a point of view, in this case, the teenager's point of view, and really say, my problems are important, I think it's what made these teen films special.
This came out just 2 years before When Harry Met Sally. And this, in a funny way, Some Kind of Wonderful deals with the same issue, which is, can boys and girls be friends? Can men and women ever be friends without sex getting in the way? And one of the things I liked about Pretty in Pink is that it ends with the idea they can just be friends. With this, they can't. But that's okay because, I mean, to be honest, When Harry Met Sally comes to the same conclusion, which is that they can't be friends. But with this, Watts wants it so badly. And that scene in the locker room when she's looking at how sexy Amanda looks in her really pretty little lace panties, and Watts, for reasons that are never really explained, is wearing men's boxers and looking at her body. You know, it's a very relatable scene, even though I have to admit I never wore men's boxers to school.
I do think that's a great scene for all of those reasons. And, you know, she is such a great character, pursuing the drumming. You know, the only thing she cares about is drumming and Keith.
Yeah. It seems to me that this is my armchair diagnosis, which is that he gave so much of his heart to the teen films, and then those teens left him, which is very hurtful. And then he had such a connection with John Candy, and they had a really fruitful working relationship. And then Candy dies. And at that point, looking at his titles, I mean, obviously Home Alone is brilliant, and that, you know, endured, and that was a huge success. After that, he kind of cashed out, as they say. He made movies that were easier, sure bets, wouldn't involve so much of his soul. And he got to spend time with his family. You know, fair play to him. You know, he made a ton of money on a lot of these movies. And he got to spend time with his sons and his wife. And really, who would criticize him for that?
He was asked why he was able to write funny, which was a good question. You know, what in your life, the question was, what happened in your life that made you funny? And his answer was extraordinary. He said, things go wrong in life. Things go wrong all the time. And you can either get depressed and cry about it, or you can laugh. And I chose to laugh. And they said, well, you know, what went wrong? He said, well, you know, I would just finally get to be with all the cool crowd at school, with my good friends. And my mum and dad would say, well, that's good, Johnny, but we're moving. Because his dad was a salesman and would move. Mm. And I think John felt constantly sort of dragged away from the friends that he had made at high school. That sense of who you need to be friends with. And they asked him, you know, Richie or Zoid? And he said, oh, Zoid. Definitely Zoid. So, you know, an outsider always, you know, trying to be accepted, but being dropped into schools where nobody knew him. So acutely aware of what was going on. It's been so great, Hadley, talking to you about these films and going back. I've learned a lot and, you know, talking to all the people who were involved in them. And it was so interesting because they had stories and they wanted to tell them. I talked about Pride Before a Fall, and it was about how proud I would be being summoned to set, how you felt that the sun had come out and that you were one of the chosen few.
Yeah.
Being summoned to set was a real honour. And John would see you and he'd wave you over. Not, you didn't have to wait over there. Come on. Talk to him right by the chair, and you're right in the centre of everything. And in that lovely soft voice of his, then say, well, you know, could you find me some music for the scene and tomorrow morning? And you'd go, that pride would immediately turn to panic, and you drive away from set going, oh my God, I've got to find the music, then the rights, and oh, and the time difference, and the lawyers, and the thing. And it was almost every time, it was that sort of glow, and then, oh, was it the same in post?
For me, that feeling was being summoned to the house. I would go out there. It could be anything from like come out and have dinner, or there were a couple times I spent the night, you know, where I slept in the pool house because we had stayed up till like 4:30 in the morning, and I was just too exhausted to drive home safely. And most of the time you're doing something like last minute tracking of music. Yeah. And he was really, really fun to be with in those moments where you had his complete attention, and he was very good at giving people his complete attention.
Yeah.
You know, it is a job that is so easy to have a very fractured attention span where, you know, you've got the phones ringing and you're on the phone and talking to him. And he was really, really good about like tuning everything out and just being like, I'm talking to Tarquin now, and that's what I'm doing.
It was also important for him to help build the film industry in Chicago to the extent that he could. My dad was very loyal to the people that he worked with here and certainly put them through, I hope they were, in total, were positive experiences, but put many people through the ringer in terms of the hours that he kept filming and, you know, the at times even outrageous amount of footage that he was accumulating. I'm sure that put crews to the test. but also I hope helped solidify the film culture here and, you know, the idea of expanding production in Chicago. And I look back very fondly on those days. I think he created a really spectacular environment.
We did feel a little bit like the poor cousin down the street with respect to Simpson Bruckheimer. We always had a film coming out in the summer. They always had a film coming out in the summer. They always spent a gazillion dollars on their films. They're big blockbuster movies, big high concept action movies. And so they got a lot of the attention. I think that when I look back on it now, we were always wanting to break that $100 million barrier in terms of box office. And he would just always like, he'd always get to like 75 and, you know, like, but if you look at the budgets of the films, if you look at how cheaply we made those films, and then you looked at how well they did, he was never hitting out of the park home runs like a Top Gun, but that guy was a money-making machine in terms of the cost of his films and what their return was. And his batting average was just unbelievably good and solid. I mean, every once in a while you'd have a She's Having a Baby. But yeah, I always felt a little bit like, you know, there was always somebody down the street that was bigger and shinier.
They had bigger offices, but of course, yeah, there's a reason for that. And that's because they had to have a development department. We didn't.
No, exactly. I really took that for granted being so young. And it was that, you know, it took him with most things that they were a 3-night to lay down a first draft of a script. So he was in a mode where it was just like whatever John wanted to do next, that's what we did. We got into a groove where we were just always had two things going, one that was finishing and one that was starting. And it was just boom, 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 boom.
In those interviews, when he was still around, and there's much of this on record, you know, the questions generally revolved around, you know, what material was culled from his own personal life, or which experiences in the movie did, you know, were pulled from his real life. And then when he passed, you know, the wave of tributes or, again, assessments or reassessments of his work, you know, reporters or writers generally reached out to actors. So there's a lot on record to be learned about the actors he worked with, the rehearsal process, casting, you know, stories from the set. And I think it's interesting now that it's been, you know, more than 13 years since he passed. There is this, you know, I would say sort of this new cycle is an acknowledgement of the craft that was involved in the making of these movies. And when you mentioned Paul Hirsch, you know, he comes to mind as well because he published his book about his experiences in his career as an editor. And there's a chapter in there devoted to Ferris, one for Planes, Trains as well.
I feel very privileged that I got to work at close quarters with a director that sort of married commerce and art. You know, he was driving for commerce, but somehow made art along the way. And, you know, I feel lucky.
Well, I've told people that they're talking to the luckiest person they'll ever meet. That's my attitude. Star Wars, Carrie, you know, Mission Impossible, Footloose.
Your CV is a thing of beauty, Paul. He was the first director, writer I ever worked with. I didn't know how great he was. How could you know? There was no benchmark. It's not like I'd worked with all these crappy, and now finally I'm working with the good guy. He'd send me a script. I go, yeah, that's good.
I started working for Coppola before him, but I still, every day on that set with John and seeing what he would do, and even when he was writing at night, and still to this day, I am in awe of the man. I mean, I just feel like, what he would do with music and his films and how music really drove his scripts. It drove him the way he would write and just watching him direct even everything.
Well, going back to, you know, why he didn't really like film directing, if you remember one thing about your conversations with John, they were long. If he called you up, you knew you were on the phone for half an hour, whatever. They were long.
I mean, and when you say long, you are not kidding. My last conversation with John before he died, I came into my office and I hadn't spoken to him probably in a couple of years. And my assistant at the time said, John Hughes is on line one for you. I remember I looked up at the clock and it was 10 to 9. And I took that phone call. And Tarquin, when I hung up the phone call, I had stood up my lunch date. That's how long the call was. And by the way, thank God I picked it up, because it was the last time I talked to him. It was a super cathartic conversation where we discussed everything about us and where he was as a filmmaker and what was important to him in his life at that time.
This has been the pinnacle of my career, honestly, Tarquin. This has just been a joy, just talking about John Hughes with someone who worked with John Hughes and was friends with John Hughes. And also the man who introduced me to so much music, Tarquin. I mean, without you, I would not have known about Psychedelic Furs, OMD, The Smiths. I mean, you brought them all to New York in the 1980s. So thank you so much for that.
I didn't realize I was doing it, but I'm immensely happy that I did. Let's finish by looking at some of John's trademarks. You know, if you had to identify what the John Hughes trademarks are, I'll start with music, obviously, because that's what I was involved with. And I think for the teen movies, his use of music was different and front and center. Is there anything you'd like to mention?
Well, the most obvious is, of course, the settings. So always the suburbs of Chicago for John Hughes. And just the cleverness of the scripts. Certainly Ferris Bueller or Pretty in Pink have endured. The scripts are so much more timeless. He creates these characters who you feel you could know today. They're not bogged down in the time. They're not bogged down with a very shallow idea of what teens were like back then. They are real people with real souls is how they feel.
They deal with the issues that we still deal with today, the poor v. rich, the problem of breaking out of your class, and ultimately the triumph of the underdog, the triumph of the outsider, not changing under pressure from parents or peer group. That's something that we all enjoy and wish to have in our lives. And then the final thing, he was always romantic. He liked romance. He was unabashedly romantic. There's always a kiss at the end of the film. But here's the big one, physical comedy.
Yes.
He managed to balance physical comedy with heart brilliantly, I think.
Yep, completely.
What was your first meeting with John like? Did you fly out to Chicago?
They had set up a suite of offices on the Paramount lot. So I went in there, and John, he spoke 95% of the time. And he's very funny, and, you know, he's just very entertaining. And I tell people he's the funniest man I ever met.
Yeah.
He could have me crying with laughter whenever he wanted. I mean, it was just a gift that he had. And he enjoyed deploying it, too, I think. You know, he liked to make people laugh.
There was no one like John Hughes, and there's been no one like him since. There's a reason his name is a byword for timeless teen movies, and that's because the movies he made will last, I think, just forever.
We want to end with some thoughts from John's son, James.
Oh, excellent.
Along with his brother, John Hughes III, was involved in the creation of the brilliant box set that inspired this podcast. And here he is giving us some of his thoughts on his dad's career.
You know, I wanted to kind of make sure to mention this, you know, taking sort of a broad view. You know, what struck me most when you first brought the idea of the box set was that it was a project that both illustrates and celebrates the importance of the post-production process on my father's work, which to me, you know, remains the most overlooked but sort of crucial component to what made the movies of this period work. I think for fans, you know, what made the movie so memorable or quotable or rewatchable was how they were constructed in the editing room. And, you know, of course, what ties that all together was music. To sort of disrupt these dialogue-heavy movies with musical interludes or montages or sometimes even almost sort of quasi-surreal sequences that involve music. And then the songs that you guys chose were given more space to kind of shine and elevate his work. And I think he always had the confidence that his material would work on the page. But I think working in post with good editors and a good music department, what has made them so enduring to, you know, those who love them, And I do like that the box set shows the importance of the Hughes Entertainment team. You know, you and Ron Payne and Jane and Emma and Bill Brown and all these people who factored into the box set and contributed in some, you know, major ways. I think it's good to, you know, finally explore that side of his work.
We hope you listeners have enjoyed Life Moves Pretty Fast podcast, presented by me, Tarquin Gotch, and Hadley Freeman. And I hope you go out and buy the box set, because it's brilliant. Thank you so much for listening.
The Life Moves Pretty Fast podcast was a joint collaboration between Gimme Sugar Productions and Very Serious Comedy.